I'd like to speak this evening with regard to a possibility that exists for us all to really awaken the beautiful qualities of our hearts and minds, to bring them to bear in a life of nobility. And this retreat, as we described it or entitled it, the Embodying the Awakened Heart, there are some particular qualities that are very much the embodiment of the awakened heart that are known in the tradition as the parami, sometimes the perfections, although that word's a little difficult. I'm not sure it's really the best translation, although it's the one that's used. It's qualities that can be developed further and that are described as in the Buddha's life, in his embodiment of the fulfillment of human potential, as having been brought to their completion, their fulfillment, their perfection, one could say. Their complete development, I think, is perhaps a more useful way to describe it. And so this group of qualities which I'd like to speak about, they're very much part of a vision of practice in which the journey of our inner exploration and development is in the service of not just our own well-being, but the welfare of all being, of all that lives. And the story of the Buddha, as it's told in the tradition, relates that within the models and we could say metaphysics of traditional Buddhism, however we may relate to them, that the Buddha in a previous life encountered, when he wasn't a Buddha then, it was a previous life, he encountered the Buddha of that time, who was a remarkably wise and compassionate being. And it's said that at that time the Buddha had the capacity to actually get enlightened. He was actually developed enough, but when he saw that Buddha, whose name was Dipankara, he was inspired to not just kind of discover his own freedom as quickly as he could, but to develop all the qualities of the human heart and mind that this Buddha had developed, which he himself could develop, and if he did so, would enable him to more fully serve the welfare of others than if he simply sort of had a quick fix of insight and sort of got to sort of dust his hands off. Now, it's a kind of an interesting image, and I'm not sure how useful it is for us, but there's something of significance to me in that it's suggesting that there are dimensions of awakening or possibilities of awakening that are something about simply just penetrating through, which is powerful and important and essential, in fact, in spiritual practice and the maturing of our journey. But there's also something very broad. There's also something very wide that involves the whole of the human being in the transformation. So that sometimes it looks like in spiritual practice we're kind of working out how to and learning the skills of being able to kind of, in a way, disengage from a lot of the human activities and the confusions and the foibles and the conditioning and the history and all the limitation that brings. And there's something important in being able to do that. And that's part of what we learn. But the fullness of practice, the fullness of spiritual development actually involves the transformation of everything that is human into something which is not just human, but we could say more than that. And so these qualities I'd like to speak about are understood as what we need to develop for that fullness, for that breadth, for that completion of the, in a way, the widest and greatest potential of the human being. And these qualities are I'll give the Pali names. Pali is the language the Buddha's teachings were recorded in, and then the translation. Dana, which is generosity. Sila, which is non-harming. Nikama, renunciation. Virya, energy, effort. Kanti, patience. Sakya, truthfulness. Upeka, equanimity. Adhitana, resolve or determination. Punya, wisdom. And metta, loving kindness. Now, we've actually spoken about quite a few of these in different ways, and I'm sure you've encountered them in the context of Buddhist or Dharma teachings, and I'm sure you will have encountered them also in the context of your lives, because these are very human qualities. They're not specifically the possessions of a Buddhist tradition, but here they're organized in a way which I'd just like to share. And so the first of the qualities that's spoken of in this group of parami that the Buddha spoke of is generosity. The sense of sharing, a sense of offering what we have for the welfare, for the benefit of others. And it's something really beautiful, it's something very natural. I'm often struck by, for myself and also for others, how I see when we encounter, say, a wild creature or even a domestic animal, often the urge is to want to give it something to eat. Have you ever had that experience? Where you just really love to be able to give it something to eat. I know sometimes we have these little rabbits, these little bunnies that hop around on the lawn at Gaia House, and they seem to have completely stopped being worried about human beings, because the human beings all travel pretty slowly, and they don't seem to be pretty aggressive. So the rabbits just kind of wander around. But when I see the little ones, some of the big ones are cute too, but the little ones, it's like I just kind of want to grab them, and, there's a sense of I just want to give them some kind of love or food. And of course that would scare the heck out of them, so it's not a good idea to try and do that, but that natural response we have to life, and of course to people we care about and we love too, and easily there can be the sense of offering. Leela spoke very beautifully of that really touching sense of how sometimes poor people with very little will offer the best they have. And I've had that experience too, in a way in which it's painful almost to receive, knowing that they need this more than me. But the joy that they get from giving it, I can't deprive them of that. And it's a teaching that's amazing to see. I also often find myself really touched watching what happens for people in the monasteries when there's the opportunity to give food and clothing and support to the nuns and the monks who live dependent upon that giving. And I have this very clear sort of image and picture of the sense of the joy of these little girls just taking a bunch of flowers and giving them to one of the nuns. Just the sense of having something to give that's beautiful. These little 6-7-year-old girls just taking it. And just the amount of joy that we get from sharing, from giving. It's something really powerful. Something really beautiful. And it kind of frees something in our heart. It opens something in our heart when we share things. It gives us a sense of enough in life, when actually we often have enough, but we don't always realize it. We don't always quite remember that there is enough, because our life is sustained. One of the suggestions the Buddha made with regard to giving, sharing and generosity, he said that if you're angry with someone, give them a gift. It's a really interesting instruction. Expressing generosity to someone we're annoyed or angry with, it's like it's the last thing we want to do. Even thinking about the idea is actually kind of an interesting practice. Yeah? But it's like sometimes just finding that movement or that response of generosity is a way that we can reconnect with our own heart. And often the most painful thing in getting caught in anger or reactivity is that loss of connection with our heart. And the Buddha said, it's great if you can practice deep meditation and insight and understanding, but sometimes that's not possible. And, you may have noticed that on occasion. He said, if you can't do that, it's great just to practice calm and stillness and, And if you can't do that, and there's a whole sort of range of different options in a sense, if you can't do that, at least, don't cause any harm. But if you can't help but cause any harm, then it's always possible to express something with some kind of generosity in some way or form. It's kind of a fallback. It's like a bottom line, and it's a universally recognized and honored capacity that we all have, that we can practice. And, you know, ultimately, with what we have, what we think we have, if we can't give it away, we don't really own it. It owns us. Now, we live in a world where people are more and more owned by the things they have than the other way around. And there's a remarkable phenomenon going on in England. I don't know if it's happening here or in other parts of the world. I imagine so. But people have got so many things, and there's more things and new versions of the things that you've already got constantly being offered. And so their houses are full of things. There's nowhere for them to go. So either they kind of lose the space to move in, or they get some more space. And maybe you can get a bigger house if you have lots of money, but lots of people are hiring spaces. There's these rental storage spaces now. Maybe some of you have got them. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. You know, I've got a garage I keep some stuff in. But it's really interesting how much money is being made out of people needing somewhere to put all their stuff that they didn't used to have, and that they've got it in a box. It's not like they're using it, but they might maybe one day want it. It's like, oh wow, gosh, that stuff starts to own us. And sharing it. I have a friend, he buys books, he reads them, he gives them away. He doesn't have to worry about needing more shelves. I think it's a wonderful practice. And there's many other ways we can practice that too. I heard a remarkable story about the kind of miracles that one sometimes hears, or beautiful things one sometimes hears around someone with real generosity in their heart. It was from a friend of mine. I've been to the place it concerned. A friend of mine lived in a community in New Mexico, in southern, southwest America. It was a sort of spiritual community connected with Ramdas. I wasn't strictly Buddhist, but there's a lot of people there involved with the insight meditation world, which is how I came to know them. And my friend and this other person, they went for a visit to one of the local sort of Native American villages, and they found there these two exquisitely crafted bowls. And they just fell in love with these two bowls. But they were really, really expensive. No, there's no way we can afford those. But they said, oh, we love them. I love them. Okay. So, let's have them. Yeah. Splash out. These weren't people with a lot of money. But they said, okay, I really would like to have this. So they each bought one of these two bowls and took them home. And it was like this treasured possession. This treasured possession. And my friend said that sometime later she heard that her friend, there'd been an accident and the bowl had got broken, and she was devastated, completely distraught, really sad, because she loved this thing. She loved this thing, and it was a great opportunity for reflecting on the teachings, impermanence and all of that, attachment and all of that. But actually my friend said, actually what she said was, oh, you know, I was first of all glad it wasn't my bowl that got broken. It was like, phew. But then I realized that I wanted to give it to her. And I couldn't it's like I didn't want to. I wanted my bowl, but I wanted to give it to her. And she said, so in the end I had to listen to that, and I went and gave her the bowl. I said, I'm really sorry your bowl got broken. I'd like you to have my bowl. And it so happened that this friend, she lived in this community, as I said, Lama Foundation is what it's called, and probably it was 6 or maybe 12 months later, there was a devastating fire at Lama Foundation. Almost all of the buildings burnt. The place was destroyed. Fortunately, no one was killed or hurt seriously. But almost everyone lost everything. Everything they had was gone. And they were sitting together, sort of just talking about how fortunate they were that they were still alive. And feeling the pain of the loss of this thing they'd built. And she said, and her friend came walking up the path. She had in her hand something wrapped up and gave it to her. And it was the bowl. Her friend gave it back. It was the only thing of her life from before that she still owned at this point. And she said, you know, the only reason I have it is because I gave it away. If it had been here during the fire, it would have been destroyed with everything else. And something kind of remarkable in that story, that maybe you know similar examples of the power of what happens when we just listen to that heart's movement in terms of sharing, in terms of offering. The second of the parami is sila, non-harming, or ethics, which we talked about in regard to the precepts in this retreat, and that sense of that foundation of caring for the welfare of others by not causing harm so far as we can. And this really fundamental principle to treat others as we would wish to be treated. That's the simple guideline that if we look actually is there in many, many spiritual traditions one way or another. To treat others as we would wish to be treated. How else could we then expect to be treated ourselves the way we wish to be treated if we do not respond and act in that way with others? And understanding that when we cause harm to others, it actually harms us. It actually causes pain to us. And this is some of what we have explored and talked about, and processes and practices of forgiveness are really important for working with and handling when we see, obviously, the impact of where we've caused harm. It's not that we can avoid it. Sometimes it's impossible to not cause harm one way or another. But nonetheless, doing what we can to refrain from causing harm. Really caring in that way. This is something central. Fundamental, without which meditation really doesn't go anywhere. And I, again, would like to just share a really interesting story in terms of, you know, we talk about the teaching of karma, and sometimes it's sort of got this idea of a very literal sort of process of you do something and something happens, but it's not really like that. It's about the sense of the basic quality that we're acting on is what gets reinforced. So if we act on some kind of greedy or selfish disregard or angry sort of wishing to harm somebody else, that actually that very anger or greed that causes us to act in a way that's harmful to someone else, that becomes stronger, and that actually is harmful to us. As we see how much pain we experience in our own patterns of reactivity, of greed, of anger. But this story is kind of different than some of the ways I more often speak about karma. And I talked about this topic once in the context of ethics and taking precepts and really holding that. And this woman who was a practitioner of meditation, she lived in a town in Massachusetts near where I was living when I was living and working at Insight Meditation Society some years ago. And she said she'd been living with a friend, well, actually it was more of an acquaintance really, in a house together, and they'd been sharing for a while, getting on quite well, and then something happened. And she suddenly was kind of upset and angry. She didn't go into details with the person she'd been living with. She decided to move out. She said, okay, I'm going to leave. And as she was packing up her things to go, and the person wasn't there, she looked at this, they had this really nice clothes rack for drying clothes, this wooden clothes rack that folded up really nicely, opened up, it was well made, good quality. She thought, I don't think it's hers. It must have been kind of ours or nobody's or something. Maybe it was here in the place when we moved in. So she said, I'm taking it. She took it. She kind of knew it wasn't really hers, but she took it anyway, she said. And I was so happy because it's such a nice clothes rack, she said. And I found another place to live. And someone else moved in with me and we lived together for a while. And then somewhere along the line, that person said that they decided they needed to move out. And I thought, fine, that's, yeah, you can move out. I'll find someone else. She said, and when I came home the day after that person moved out, the clothes rack was gone. And she was just amazed. Remarkable. It's not always that literal how things happen. But there's something about making a commitment to respect the precepts, to not cause harm, so far as we can in our lives, that really makes a difference. Because it's our actions that are our true possessions. Our actions and the intentions that they spring from. And so we understand these in the teachings to be what we take with us. Because everything else gets left, all the things get left behind. The body gets left behind. But the actions and intentions have a momentum to them that carries on. And so part of what's important about being mindful, present and awake is that we get to choose carefully when we act. When we're present, we can choose. When we're not present, we just react. Repeat actions from the past. React. And that sense of, okay. It's always worth pausing when we're not sure if we might cause harm. Not that we can always be sure, but just pausing and seeing what can I do to, as best as I'm able, not perfection, not being perfect at it, but as best as I'm able, not cause harm here. That doesn't mean we can't protect ourselves or say no when we need to say no to something harmful. But that quality of sila brings a sense of trust in our hearts and trust in the world, a sense of inner safety that is one of the most valuable things we can have. The third of the parami is renunciation, nikamma. This kind of, we've talked about this again, a sense of letting go, of releasing, of kind of not always having to go with what I want or what I don't want. And for most people in the West, this is a kind of an unpopular idea. It sounds a lot like deprivation, or sort of like, I don't want to be a renunciate. That sounds like a miserable life, having, you know, those monks who have no clothes except a brown curtain and have to eat whatever someone gives them and don't get to choose whether they want ice cream in the afternoon or not, you know. It sounds like it's going to be really unpleasant. And yet, it's really interesting because it's not about deprivation. Letting go, renunciation in that sense, isn't about pushing things away, but about actually our relationship to the conditioned urges of wanting and not wanting. Seeing that we didn't actually choose the things we want or like. You know, we don't choose what we prefer. Have you ever reflected on that? You know, some people, the classic one is, do you prefer, you know, vanilla or chocolate ice cream? Now, most of us would know we prefer this or that, or actually they're much the same to us. But we don't choose that. We can't suddenly decide, having preferred chocolate all our life, to prefer vanilla. Huh? It's something that actually has happened to us. And yet we can have so many of our choices driven by something we didn't choose. Someone was speaking in the group this morning, and rather beautifully, about just the simple choice to say, what if I don't take the kind of bread I like the most, and I try eating the kind of bread that I think I don't like at all, or like the least? And that's a simple exploration of what renunciation might mean. Oh, what's it like to try this instead? And actually, the experience turned out to be that it was fine. In fact, it was quite nice, I think, if I'm remembering how he described it. I thought, oh, how amazing. Suddenly, the fact that I prefer this one over that one doesn't have so much power in my world. Doesn't have so much authority in my life. And there's a freedom that comes in this, an immense freedom. We think of renunciation as deprivation, but in fact it's the basis of contentment and peace. And there's actually a real uplift that comes with it. That there's a story, I don't know if it's just a story or if it actually happened, but I heard it as if it did, that there was this great Sufi teacher who had many followers and students, and they came to live at the center that the teacher had established, and they practiced all the time very enthusiastically and intensively. And she was a very sort of strong and clear woman, and she said to them always, you know, it's not about things and having nice experiences and the kind of things you might have heard a little bit of what we might have said. But the thing was, they lived a very simple life like renunciates, with very little comforts or sense pleasures to entertain themselves with. But every day they observed that the master, she would go down to the market and in the market there are all these beautiful things and wonderful foods, and a bit like the market that Leela described last night, it's like, wow, you know, amazing place. And she would come back at the end of the day with a big smile on her face. And they're always a bit mystified. It's like, she's having such a great time, but why can't we? Why can't we? She says, so one of them one day got the courage up to ask and said, you know, you tell us about renunciation, about simplicity, about not just trying to get more and more things to have that we like and want. But why is it that every day you do that? And she says, you know, I go down to the market because it gives me great pleasure to see all of the things that I'm happy without. And it's true, there's a real pleasure, a real joy in seeing the things we can be happy without. Because actually, all the things one can be quite unhappy with. And that's so much the story of our times, at least in the Western world, it seems. So one Tibetan teacher said, renunciation is simply to accept what comes into your life and let go of what leaves it. Imagine how life might be if that were possible for us. Wow, just like no struggle. Accept what comes in, let go of what leaves. Not imposing our preferences onto that. In some ways, the whole practice is this letting go. And the more we let go, the more freedom we find, the less suffering there is. It's not easy to not act on, to seek to try and fulfill our cravings or act on our aversions and resistances. But if we look at it, when we act on them, they get stronger. And that's the question to ask. I find it really interesting sometimes when I'm kind of thinking, oh, I really want to do that thing because I know it'll be good, but I know it's not I mean, good isn't, it might be nice, but it's not actually really going to serve my well-being. And it's like asking, okay, what do I want to support here? It's like if I'm going to eat something that's actually not good for me, even though it tastes nice, it's like sometimes to ask, okay, what am I serving here? Because if I'm serving my bodily well-being, that will strengthen. But if I'm serving my greed, that will strengthen. And so often, does that sense of, oh, actually, do I want to feed this urge to have more? Maybe I don't. Maybe I don't. And so renunciation in that sense is about just staying steady with that urge that says, I want to push this away. Or I want to grab some more of these. Particularly in line with our preferences, where it's not actually about our well-being or our survival. With those kind of preferences, sometimes it's really interesting just to explore what it's like to put them down for a little while. I sometimes eat celery when someone serves it to me, never really by choice, but I really dislike the taste of celery. Lots of people really seem to think it's great. I have no idea how that could be. But as a practice, I find it really interesting just sometimes just to eat some celery. Because it's come to me. You know, to not actively pick it out of the salad and just eat it. Hasn't happened here, fortunately. Maybe it's on tomorrow's salad, I don't know. If it is, put it in, don't worry. Someone's concerned when I say that, that people might think, oh, we can't have celery when Yano's teaching. It's really interesting. And it's actually uplifting in a very simple but beautiful way. So the next to the parami is virya, effort, energy, this sense of how we have to arouse ourselves to engage in this, to be present, to be awake, and to let go. All of that requires energy because of the force of conditioning, the force of habit. It's like these grooves that have been established in our hearts and minds. And the Buddha talks about how there's these grooves. You know, if you keep repeating something, it just gets stronger and more compelling. And yet, when we start recognizing what doesn't serve our well-being, we have to really actually make an effort to say, no, I don't want to keep repeating that behavior. I don't want to keep enacting that pattern. And find some way to initially begin to pause or just slow down. It might be that we can't quite stop ourselves some of the time. And that's a really painful place to be. It's one of the most painful places, is when we can actually see ourselves doing something we know that isn't for our well-being, but we can't quite yet stop it happening. But just the seeing of it, making the effort to see it and to be clear, that's really important and ultimately where the transformation comes from. Because we see that it isn't, we allow ourselves to feel the experience that it actually isn't serving us, even though something seems to be compelled to think that it does. And so the Buddha spoke of the four great efforts as supporting the arising of wholesome qualities that haven't arisen, and supporting the sustaining of wholesome qualities that have arisen. And he also spoke of the supporting the non-arising of unwholesome qualities that haven't arisen, and supporting the diminishing and dropping away of unwholesome qualities that have arisen. So the effort in terms of practice is seeing, okay, where these things have come or arisen that are wholesome, how can I support them? And the interesting thing, again, as Lila was speaking about last night, that the awareness of its wholesomeness actually means that it becomes supported. It strengthens if we're aware of it and the fact that it's wholesome. It's natural, because there's actually intelligence in the system, believe it or not. Sometimes we might doubt and wonder about that, but there is remarkable intelligence in the system when we actually allow ourselves to see what's true. And likewise with the unwholesome, this awareness of it, it starts to diminish, because when we start to see that it's not serving us, something in that urge to follow through with the unwholesome or unskillful behavior slowly starts to dissolve and break down. And it may take time. It may take some considerable time, but it's possible for us. And that effort is required to sustain through the times when it's not happening so quickly or so easily. But it's a little bit like gardening, growing plants or food. You know, we dig the soil, we maybe take out weeds, add compost, add water, try and keep it somewhere warm if it needs that. But in the end, the seeds grow by themselves. It's the nature of things that can grow when placed in moisture and warmth and soil that they will grow. And our work isn't that we make the growing happen, but that we take care of the conditions which support it in terms of being present, in terms of being open. And so the effort in that to be present, to be awake, to be open, to allow the seeds of our heart to germinate, to blossom, to bear fruit. And it's their nature to do this. It's unstoppable. Just as when you put a seed with moisture and warmth in the earth, it can't help but grow. And the next of the parami is patience, kanti. And this is what the Buddha gave as the first rule of training, the first principle and foundation, patience. We've talked a lot about beginning again. We have a remarkably, fortunately large number of opportunities to practice patience. If we feel like we're not very good at it, don't worry. You've got time. You don't need to rush getting patience. You know, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? And there's a lovely story that I think pretty much says it all in regard to this. I mean, we've said some, as I say, already. But there's a story I heard about a long-time meditator and student of Tibetan Buddhism who had the opportunity for an audience with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And I think he might have been from America, and he'd been practicing for about 20 years with real dedication and commitment, and he had this chance for a brief audience with His Holiness. And so in the meeting he came and he bowed and said, you know, I'd like to tell you about my meditation. I've been practicing for 20 years and I have these real difficulties and struggles and challenges. And he outlined the various things that were really hard and difficult and challenging and painful in his practice. And His Holiness listened and nodded and, you know, sounded sort of, make sort of compassionate noises, as one might expect. And the story goes that the student, the practitioner, was expecting some really, you know, sort of some advice on how to sort all these out. And His Holiness, he says, "Can you tell me what to do?" His Holiness smiled, he looked at him, he said, you know, it is difficult, isn't it? It's like that in the early years of practice. And it's, in one sense, so wonderful, isn't it? If you think of the first 20 years as the early years. Oh, okay. We give ourselves a lot more space when we're just beginning, don't we? And how amazingly arrogant it is for us to think somehow, oh, you know, I did a weekend retreat or a couple of retreats last year. I'm not a beginner. Hey, we're still beginners. We might be beginners for a while. That's a graceful place to be. There's a lot of grace in being a beginner. And so, okay, taking a long view, less pressure, less demand, just one step at a time. So yes, that sense of effort, of commitment, of engagement is there, but within a sense of spaciousness, so that these qualities balance and support each other. And the next of the parami is sakya, truthfulness, honesty. And it's, again, something really powerful, something really beautiful, to be honest with others. To support the possibility of trust between human beings by being honest. It's such a rare, precious and powerful thing. It's amazing how much we're touched in the small group meetings when we hear each other speaking honestly. Just sharing what's true. It doesn't have to be great or remarkable or tragic. It might be simple and ordinary. But the truth of it, that sense of human honesty, speaks to us, goes straight through all our ideas and projections about who people might be or what we think about them or don't. And we kind of find so much a sense of connection, a sense of beauty in honesty when it's being shared. And with this honesty, the Buddha's suggestion was that one needs to not just say what is true, but also what is useful. So it's not always telling people about what we're sure is true about them, because that's not always useful. So it's good to understand that in this regard. But being honest with ourselves is equally important, and sometimes more challenging. Sometimes we think that being honest with ourselves is all about seeing, you know, the things that aren't good news, you know, our limitations, our failures, our, you know, our various patterns of negativity or conditioning and habit. And it's true, it's really important to let ourselves see those, begin to just take on board, oh yeah, actually, yeah, I'm kind of grumpy in these kind of situations, or actually I'm pretty tight around that, yeah, and this, or I'm not very friendly. I always thought I was really friendly. My wife recently pointed out to me, she said, you're not very friendly. I say, I'm really nice to people. She says, yeah, but when you sort of go past someone, you don't engage them in conversation that often. You just kind of walk past. Friendly people start talking and talking and talking. And I thought, oh, is that what friendly is? Oh, okay, so I'm not so much that. Yeah, I'm quite happy just to smile and keep going. In fact, sometimes I'm kind of relieved if I don't have to stop and talk to them. So maybe that isn't friendly. You know, and it's kind of, oh, okay, a bit of self-knowledge. It's always useful. Yeah, but interestingly for us, often it's really harder for us to be honest with ourselves about our good qualities. To really let ourselves see and honour and even treasure the things of beauty within us, the ways in which we have grown and developed, the good and kind and beautiful actions and expressions of nobility, of honesty, of generosity, of kindness, of compassion, that we have all expressed many times in our lives. You know, I don't know if it's the case in Finland, but certainly in many countries I go to, and I'm guessing it might be the same here, that if I were to ask people, say, okay, I want to list 10 things about yourself that really could do with improvement. Most people could do it, wouldn't be too hard. And if I said, and I'd like you to read them out in front of everyone now, there'd be a bit of but probably most people could do that okay. But if I said, I want you to list 10 things about yourself that are really great, that would take a little longer for most of us, wouldn't it? It would be a bit harder. It would be going, And then if I said, okay, now I want you to read them out in front of the group, deadly silence. Most places it would be like, one or two countries, it might be different. But it's really often a lot harder for us to be honest in that sense of, let ourselves truly see how remarkable, how beautiful, how hard we're working, how much we do the best we can within the limitations and the circumstances of our lives and the conditions we're in. To really be honest about that, it's something really important and beneficial. And it's often the place we need to work on more than drumming up longer and longer lists of the things we need to improve about ourselves. So the next of the parami is upekkha, equanimity, which is one of the divine abidings that Leela spoke about a few nights ago, these qualities of heart. And just so again, just to say a little more with regard to that, the sense of being open to all. And equanimity is sometimes we have this idea that it's like being distant or removed, and it's not at all. You know, equanimity isn't distant or removed. One teacher said it's to be equally near to all things. So equanimity, it's the same root as equal, to be equally near to all things. And the image that's used is like the sunshine. It just spills out, and when the sky is clear, it touches everything. It doesn't sort of shine here and not shine there. It's just that sense of openness to everything. And it's not easy for us to be really open to things. It's important to understand that. To really have compassion for ourselves in this territory where we don't find it easy. And there's a poem I'd like to read. I think that, for me, it speaks very well to this. And it's entitled If. Now, I think it's based, they're not derived closely from, the poem by Rudyard Kipling called If. I don't know if you know that poem. It's this sort of classical English poem about a sort of a very sort of, I guess, Victorian model of a really noble sort of being. And it's a, if you can be, you know, sort of kind and not proud and walk with kings and all this stuff, and in the end you'll be a man, my son. It's a very lovely poem in one sense. In another sense it's a little bit but anyway, this isn't that poem, but it is based on it. So I say that in case you know that poem. It's entitled If. It says, if you can sit quietly after difficult news, if in financial downturns you remain perfectly calm, if you can see your neighbours travel to fantastic places without a twinge of jealousy, if you can happily eat whatever is put on your plate, if you can fall asleep after a day of running around without a drink or a pill, if you can always find contentment just where you are probably a dog. So there's things we can learn from our fellow creatures. And sometimes we see qualities embodied around us and we can actually, oh yeah, this can be possible for us. So it's not easy, because we can feel sometimes so strongly pushed and pulled. And to be able to be honest with ourselves, to acknowledge, oh yeah, I'm feeling pushed or pulled. Well, there is some strength of reactivity arising. Now, equanimity is different than tranquility or calm, which is sometimes kind of confused with, in that calm or tranquility, which is passiti in the Pali, in the Buddha's teachings, that quality is, it's like when things are really flat and calm. It's like water with no ripples on it. And then, of course, it feels kind of nice and it's easy to feel stable and steady. But equanimity is actually the capacity to stay steady when the waves are rolling in. And so it's not an absence of reactivity, but the ability to handle the reactivity or to handle the circumstances that give rise to our reactivity. And it's like to have stability in a storm. In a boat, what you need is a deep keel. Do you know that word keel? That piece that goes from the bottom of the boat into the water, that stops it tipping over when the wind blows or the waves come. And that quality that equanimity offers us, and that we develop through rooting or establishing ourselves in a deepening connection with the present moment, with being right here, and we start to see and trust that we can connect and stay present even in the face of some very powerful waves that we encounter. We start to trust in that capacity, that there's something deeper we can connect with and rest in. Just as the waves on the surface of the water would blow the boat over, but the keel dropping down into the unmoving depths of the ocean holds it steady and stable. And so there's this sense of kind of rooting into our life. It's like our, you know, bottom getting really rooted on our cushion or our chair. A quality of uprightness that can receive and sometimes move or sway, but stay upright with what comes. And what tends to happen when we get caught with a movement of craving or grasping, it's like we go out of balance, we lean forward towards. And when we're off balance, it's easy for us to be knocked over. Or with aversion, it's like energetically we're backing off, we're pulling away. And again, we're off balance. So equanimity is that place where we actually stay central or steady in a sort of centralized position internally. Like, yes, I can meet this experience. It doesn't mean I like it. It doesn't mean I don't have a response to it. But I can meet this experience and my response and stay steady. And the next of the parami is adhitana, resolve, determination. And I like even the word, how it sounds, adhitana. You pronounce it by sort of spitting out that particular syllable. At least that's how I pronounce it. There's probably a more subtle way to make the same noise. Adhitana. And it's about this clear intention and commitment in practice, resolve to say, okay, this is what is important to me. I will place this at the center of my life. And that's it. Not negotiating. When we come into the sitting and say, I'm going to stay here till the end of the sitting. It requires a commitment. It requires a resolve. It's like, yes, I'm going to stay here. Now, sometimes we might need to change our position, sure. But we're not moving in one sense. We're right here. And the Buddha, in what was described as his fulfillment of the completion, fulfillment and perfection of this quality, when he took the seat under the Bodhi tree on the night of his enlightenment, and he was still just an unenlightened spiritual practitioner like ourselves. And he went to the seat, or the place under the tree, and he said, I will not move from this seat until I have understood, I have realized what can be realized by human endeavor. He said, I will not move from this seat, though my blood runs dry, though my bones turn to dust, I will not move until I have understood, I have realized that which can be realized by human endeavor. And I kind of get almost a shiver down my spine when I repeat those words and just feel into that fullness of heart, that commitment and dedication of, I will not move. And he had to face a lot. It wasn't an easy night. And yet, in the fulfillment of that resolution, something remarkable awoke in him. And so, for ourselves, this I will not move, it doesn't mean we have to go and sit under a tree for 12 hours or whatever like that and not move, or that we can't sort of sometimes adjust our posture when we need to. But it's like that orientation to our inner commitment to, okay, I want to be awake, I want to be present. I will do what I can to deepen my practice, to sustain this which is most important to me in my life. And that resolve is what sustains and carries us in our life. It's that which brings us back when we get lost, distracted, or confused. And so that sense of what is it that's important, and really committing to that. Each of us have to do this for ourselves. And the next quality of the parami is wisdom, punya, understanding. We've spoken a lot of this, to see things as they are. Out of our training and cultivating this quality of being awake and present, we start to see what's happening. And the nature, and I would say as a good working definition of wisdom, wisdom is that which, when we act upon it, leads to the reduction of suffering, to the ending of suffering. That's the nature of wisdom. When we act upon it, it leads to the reduction, the dissolution, and the ending of suffering. And so we talk about this as a path of wisdom in the service of coming to know for ourselves the end of suffering, what that is. And in this we see, and there are many levels of seeing, and one of those levels is the seeing of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, of anicca, and dukkha, of anatta, of the non-self nature of things that come and go, that flow and move. And in that beginning to let go of our ideas and our conceivings that hold us separate from life, so that we start to recognize and see that this life, this movement, has its particularity, and sometimes it's exquisite and sometimes it's excruciating in its particularity for us. Sometimes beautiful and sometimes incredibly challenging. And yet within all of that, this wave that we could say our life is not and cannot be separate from the water of the ocean. That there's this something larger in us, this vastness of life that we are part of, that we are not different than, in the same way that an ice cube floating in water is both different and apparently separate from, and yet ultimately not different from, that in which it resides, and which, by the very nature of its interaction, of its being in that medium, has no choice but to dissolve, to return to that from which it was formed, out of which it came. And this wisdom of seeing the end of separation, seeing through the appearance of things, reveals an immediacy and a freedom that's just simple, ordinary, not in one way at all remarkable, and yet at the same time, exquisite. And in seeing this non-separateness of life, the natural response of our heart is kindness, metta. Again, we've spoken of this some, at some length. The nature of kindness, of love, of metta, of this expression of our awakening hearts, of our awakened heart, is that it doesn't see what it sees as something other than itself. And that the caring that's natural, that's innate, that's unstoppable, just wishes to spread out, to flow, to touch ourselves, each other, and all beings. This movement of kindness that we've practiced, that we've cultivated, that we've been talking about and exploring, this is the final and tenth of the parami. These qualities of heart that can be perfected, that can be brought more and more fully into our being. And with this, to understand that we just do what we can here. It's not that we can do everything for everyone. And yet, in our heart's wish for all beings, we may nonetheless wish that. Whatever we do makes a difference. And it's really important to understand that. whatever we do makes a difference. There's a great story about a woman walking along a beach in which thousands of starfish, you know starfish? Those five-legged creatures from the sea? Thousands of them had been thrown on the beach in high tide and were dying in the sun. This woman, she was just throwing them one at a time, throwing them back. And this other person came along and said to her, "What are you doing that for? There's thousands of these starfish, they're going to die. What you're doing makes no difference, makes no sense." She picked up another starfish and threw it in. She said, "Makes a difference for that one." We aren't necessarily given the capacity to do all the things in the world we might wish to do. But what we can do, it's so important that we do. Because that's actually the healing of our heart. That we do what we can. We don't hold back from that. Because it's not as much as we would wish. And we also can see and need to really honour those places where we recognise that that's all I can do. That's all I can offer. That's all I can give. I remember the incredible painfulness of seeing when travelling amongst really poor people, that though part of me said, you could just give them everything you've got. What a difference it would make to their lives if you cashed all your traveller's checks, still used traveller's checks in those days, and just gave it to these people. You could transform them. And I realised I couldn't do it. Something in me was still, and is still, too attached to what I had. And actually that's the place where we have to have compassion for ourselves. Kindness towards ourselves, to see our own limitation. Okay, that's as far as I can go for now. But in the tenderness of that, there's also the aspiration to see how much further can this heart travel in that direction. So the sense of our life is one that's really given in the spirit of this possibility of our life in the service of life itself, for the welfare of all beings. Ourselves included and fully. And of course those we have most responsibility for, our immediate concern and responsibility is there. But that we allow our heart to be open to them all and to find a way for our life to be an expression of that. And in the service of this we can cultivate these beautiful qualities. These qualities of heart and mind. And I'll just read them again. Dana, generosity. Sila, non-harming. Nikamma, renunciation. Virya, effort and energy. Kanti, patience. Sakya, truthfulness. Upekka, equanimity. Adhitana, resolve and commitment. Panya, wisdom. And metta, kindness, and within, of course, kindness, compassion and joy, as we've spoken about. So just then to finish with these paramis, perhaps just allowing them to resonate, the words and where it lands in you, I'd like to share with you, just to finish then, the words of Shantideva, who I think we've both quoted him at some point. I think I did anyway, but who lived in the 6th century in India and spoke a lot about this wish to live and to serve the well-being of all beings. And he said, and it's really his prayer and his life, he said, and you may just like to let these words play through your heart and just see. It doesn't mean you have to sign up for anything, but just noticing what this might be like or what this is like if it feels true for you. May I be a guard for those who are without protection, a guide for those who journey on the road, for those who wish to go across the water. May I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an island for those who yearn for landfall, and a lamp for all those who long for light, for those who need a resting place, a bed, for those who need help, a servant. May I be the wish-fulfilling jewel, the vase of plenty, a word of power and the supreme remedy. May I be the trees of miracles, and for every being, the abundant cow. Like the great earth and the other elements, enduring as the sky itself endures. For the boundless multitude of living beings, may I be the ground and vessel of their life. Thus, for every single thing that lives, vast in number like the boundless reaches of the sky, may I be their sustenance and nourishment, until they pass beyond the bounds of suffering. Let's just quietly sit with whatever resonance is here for us in our hearts. So may we all here in our practice together and in our lives, may we all continue to deepen in these beautiful qualities of heart and mind, the parami. That our lives may serve our own well-being and the welfare of all beings. That our lives may be an expression of wisdom and compassion, of peace and freedom. For our own welfare and for the welfare of all that lives. So thank you for your practice. Please continue. Is the bell ringer here? Could you ring the bell please at 9:05 and we'll have the sitting at 9:00. Thank you.